This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Hey, good morning. My apologies for the delay due to an urgent telephone call that drew longer than it should have. We're going to take further the idea that we started working on last night in Shul on Erev Shabbos, which revolved around trying to understand what it was that happened to the Meraglim, to these spies that Moshe Rabbeinu sent into Eretz Canaan. What caused their deterioration? The fact that we started off with people who are tzaddikim, people who the Torah refers to as Anoshim, and Chazal, paraphrased by Rashi, say, Kol Anoshim Shabamikro Loshin Chashivus, Voisoshok, Kshirim Hayu. Whenever the word Anoshim, men, is used in the Torah, it refers to men of stature, to men of standing, not to ordinary people. And at that time, they were men of stature. At that time, they were Kshirim. They were people who were straight, and they were people who were righteous in their ways. And yet, very shortly afterwards, we see problems already. As the names have finished being listed, we already see Moshe praying for the well-being of Yehoshua, adding a yud to his name. Hispalel olov, he prayed for him, says Rashi, Yoshiacho me'atzos meraglim, kol Moshiacho me'atzos meraglim, may Hashem save you from the intentions of the spies, from the plotting of the spies. So we see already there was plotting and scheming. But nothing had happened yet. They were referred to as Ksherim. They were referred to as Tzaddikim, as righteous people, as kosher people, straight people. And they listed, and immediately after the listing already, Moshe is praying for Yehoshua. Further on, we have the Rashi also quoting Chazal. Vayelchu vayavoyu. And they went and they returned. Says Rashi, Mau vayelchu. Why does it tell us that they went? Lahakish halichoson lebioson. To attach their attitude at the time of their going to their attitude at the time of their returning. Just as they returned with bad plans and intentions, so they went with bad plans and intentions. So don't think, says Rashi, that they only became this way, that they only turned against Eretz Yisrael, that they only developed this negativity when they were there, when they saw what was happening. They went already with that attitude. They went with the intention of causing trouble and mischief. What should have done that to them? What experience, what did they go through in life that should have embittered them? What did they go through in life that should have made them negative when they set out so positive? What is it that can take a man, a tzaddik, somebody so great, and not just one of them, a group of 10 people, 10 out of 12, all of them choice people, all of them people of enormous stature and incredible standing, all of them tzaddikim, yeshorim, ksherim. And what was it that happened in such a short time, an event which doesn't appear to be recorded even, that could have made all these 10 people become negative and disruptive and undermining of the future plans of Klal Yisrael? And last night we suggested an approach which we'll take a lot further this evening. Last night I mentioned that all that really had happened was that they had been elected, and that the election of a person to high office is already an experience which places him in great danger. The danger we talked about was not just the danger of arrogance. These were people too great to fall into the normal trap of arrogance. But it was the danger of the contrast that was created between their extreme fame, their extreme specialness, uniqueness as having been selected from among the whole of Klal Yisrael as the 12 representatives who would go and spy out the land. And we'll see further on what exactly they were spying for, what they were looking for. They realized that they'd been elected as the supreme representatives of Klal Yisrael, contrasted with their experience of spying, which left them with a feeling of total anonymity, because a spy must remain anonymous. And that anonymity caused a diminishment of their self-esteem. And that's, they then saw the whole land. They saw the challenge of capturing Eretz Israel through the eyes of people with diminished self-esteem. That's how we discussed it last night. And we're going to take that considerably deeper this evening. We're going to start off with a piece of the Zohar. The Zohar's disturbed dad is everybody about the same issue. What happened to them? And the Zohar says, on Daf Kuf Nun Ches, Amud Aleph, Vayishlach Oysom Moshe, Kulam Anoshim, they were all men. That means, says the Zohar, Kulhu Zakoyin Havu, they were all tzaddikim. So emphasizing what Rashi says, what Chazal say, these people were not ordinary people, these people were Anoshim, meaning tzaddikim, Zakoyin. Vereshei the Yisrael Havu, and they were the leaders of Klal Yisrael. They were the cream of the nation, they were the top people that they were. Avol inun dabru legarmayhu ito bishu. But they opted themselves for a negative approach. Before we go further, I think it's important to appreciate what attitude are we to have when we study these passages in the Chumash. Why are they there? What are we supposed to get out of them? It's not sufficient just to turn against them and say, what wicked people. Terrible thing. How could they do such a thing? We wouldn't do such a thing in their place. Because that's not true. They weren't wicked people. They were tzaddikim. But something happened which made them do something terribly destructive. Now the attitude nowadays is, even in religious circles, or perhaps particularly in religious circles, when a person does something that we find difficult to understand or to tolerate or to accept, our tendency is not to disassociate ourselves from that action, but to disassociate ourselves from that person. And we tend to write people off rather than writing actions off. Terrible thing that we do. As I mentioned in the Monday night Chumash, we have to start off with a perspective of understanding who the person is. And we have to try and interpret his actions in accordance with the person. And if we can't understand it, then we can either sympathize or we can criticize, but the criticism is the action, not the person. The person remains, if he's a good person basically, if he's a bad person, sometimes you find a bad person. He has no midas, he's corrupt, he's negative, he's disruptive, he's a Baal Machlokes, everything, you always find negative, always destructive. It's a bad person, that's something else. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the majority of cases which are when nice people, fine people, well-meaning people, good people, do things which they shouldn't do. It happens every day. And the attitude we like to take is one of such superiority and one of writing off the person. So he's no good. Not the action is no good, he's no good. That's what Bruria said to Rabbi Meir, I think it was in the Gemara, when he was having trouble from some people and he prayed that Hashem should destroy the people. And she said, you can't do that. Yitomu chatoim min ha'oretz. It says, may the sins be removed from the world. That's what David HaMelech asked for. Not yitamu chatoim min ha'oretz. Not may the sinners be removed from the world. You can't go against the people. The action you can criticize, the action you can reject, you can pray to the Ribbono Shel'olam to remove such actions from the world, but not the people. Sometimes the people are inherently good. So when we look at these meraglim, what are we meant to think? These are people who are inherently good. They're tzaddikim and they're kasherim. They took one bad step, one wrong step. It was a terribly tragic wrong step. It had the most horrendous consequences for the whole of Klal Yisrael, for our whole history. It was terrible. So we've got to adopt a very negative attitude to what they did. But what kind of attitude do we adopt to them? The attitude we must adopt to them is, this is a fascinating study. Because if it could happen to them, it could happen to any of us a million times easier. Let us try and understand them. This is an understanding of people. Let us try and understand, what is it that made it happen? And that's a fascinating study. We don't try and understand people often enough. We try and understand Gemara, and we try and understand Rambam, and we try and understand Shulchan Aruch, and we try and understand Lahavdil Shakespeare, and we try and understand science, and we try and understand mathematics, and we're intrigued by puzzles, and we're intrigued by intellectual challenges. And if we go to see a play, we like it to be something that challenges us, and we come back afterwards and we sit around having coffee and discussing what it really meant and what it was about and what it was. We like to analyze it, we like to understand it, we feel good. But people we think are simple enough not to require that same kind of attention in an effort to understand them. The most intriguing of all things in the world are people. The most intriguing of all, the most challenging of all puzzles in the world are people. And when we see great people doing things which are difficult to understand, it becomes all the more intriguing and all the more challenging to try and understand what were they going through. And one develops a sense of sympathy, a sense of empathy, a sense of identity. I too could be in that place. What does it mean in Pirkei Avos where it says, don't judge other people, ad shetagia limkoma, until you're in his position. You can't stand outside his position and make a judgment on him. You can judge the action, you can say the action is wrong, that's not difficult to do. An action which is against the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, that's simple. You don't have to be a big psychologist to say that. But that's the beginning of the challenge. The next question is to try and understand what brought such a fine person to do something so negative. From Nebuch, what was he going through? What is it? What disruptions in his life occurred? What crises was he going through? What negativity was he experiencing that brought him to that? To try and understand, to try and put it all together a little bit. And that's how we have to understand the Meraglim. What is it? What happened behind the scenes to make such great people do something so peculiar? And that's what the Zohar is worried about and says. They chose for themselves a negative route. Amai natli itado? And the Zohar asks that same question. The Zohar is fascinated. What made such tzaddikim make such a choice? What occurred? What was it that went on in their mind? In their deep, deep subconscious. Clearly this wasn't a conscious choice. Clearly such tzaddikim and ksherim didn't decide, let us go and let us come back with a negative report, and bear in mind what Rashi said, that they went the same way that they came back. It wasn't that they saw things there that made them change their intention. Their intentions were made up and fixed before they left. Deep down in their subconscious at least, if not in their conscious. And when we try to analyze the Zohar, what is it? Amai natli itado? What was it that brought them to take this line? The Zohar is not asking what conscious decision resulted in this. There wasn't a conscious decision. It was deep, deep down in their subconscious. But what was it in their subconscious that made them want to go this route? And the Zohar says something astounding. El Omru, they said, I alum Yisrael aro. If Yisrael really comes into Eretz Yisrael, Nisaber Onon Melevi Reshin, we will be dropped as leaders of the community. The Yinni Moshe Reshin Achronim, and Moshe will appoint other leaders. The Onon Zachinon Bemidbar Lemevi Reshin, while we are good enough to be leaders in the Midbar, about the Araluniski, but we are not good enough to be leaders in Eretz Yisrael. And because they chose such a bad negative route for themselves, Mesu Inun, they died, Bechol Inun de Natlin Milayhu, and everybody who accepted their words. What does Zohar say? They decided to sabotage the plan, Hashem's plan, of occupying Eretz Israel in order to maintain their own positions, to keep their jobs. That was what it was. It's astonishing. Again, we can take it on the superficial level and we say, yes, that's we see that very often, that leaders don't know when to quit. It's a standard malady of leadership, that a leader reaches his pinnacle, he reaches his high point, then things change. Now, there comes a time when he's got to get out, when he's got to clear out, and he tries to hang on, and he tries to hang on, and he tries to hang on. We had it here in South Africa only 2 years ago. And there comes a time where the person's done a wonderful job and the people need a change, they need a different type of leadership. And a leader has to be sensitive to know my job is over. So the same with the Meraglim, we would say they had a good job, they were leaders of Klal Yisrael, and they need to know when time is up, when it's time to give up. That's the way a secularist would learn it. So this is normal and standard. But we're starting from the standpoint that when you're trying to interpret a person's action, you've got to understand who you're dealing with. And if you're dealing with tzaddikim and kasherim, and not people that the Sunday Times calls tzaddikim and kasherim, the people that Chazal calls tzaddikim and kasherim, people that the Torah calls tzaddikim and kasherim, people that the Zohar calls tzaddikim and kasherim. We're talking of the highest echelon of human nobility that there is. We're talking of the finest of fine people that can be imagined. We're talking of tzaddikei olam, of people who on a universal value system are considered tzaddikim elyonim, the highest of tzaddikim. And they need to hang on to their jobs? And they're willing to sabotage the Ribbono Shel Olam's plan? What chance do they think they have of pulling this off? To keep the whole of Klal Yisrael in the Midbar forever and ever. To keep them in the desert. so that they could keep their jobs. Does that make any sense? It doesn't. So we need to understand the Zohar. And even if we'll say, as we need to say clearly, that this was deep down in their subconscious, this wasn't a conscious decision, we want to keep our jobs, and if we go into Israel, we'll lose our jobs. Clearly it wasn't conscious. Clearly it was deep in their subconscious. But that's bad enough. Still difficult to say. It's still difficult to understand. I'm going to discuss a concept with you, which parts of it we've discussed before, which won't lead to an entirely satisfactory resolution of this difficulty, but it will give us some kind of understanding of the type of conflict that they were going through. What we see from the Zohar is they were going through a personal conflict. They had a personal crisis. They saw a clash between the interests of Klal Yisrael and their own interests. That's what they saw. And as I said, superficially, what is the clash? My job versus the people. I want to keep my job, and for the people it wouldn't be a good thing, and that's the clash. But we need to understand it much deeper than that. Tzaddikim wouldn't be bothered by such a clash. So whatever the clash is, that there's some form of conflict that they're experiencing between what they know is in their interests and what they know is in the interests of the Klal. There is an inherent and very important need in all people for feedback. And there are different words for that, terms for that word feedback. The psychologists have words for it, and the psychiatrists have words for it, and there are different words for it. But it all means the same thing. A person can become insane if he's locked up in a soundproof room, in a room that does not echo his own voice, where he speaks and his voice is totally absorbed by the walls and he doesn't even hear the echo coming back to him. A person can actually go out of his mind, he can actually go insane. We need to be able to feel the effect of everything we do. If we can't sense the effect of what we're doing, as far as we're concerned, what we're doing has no value. It has no purpose. It isn't real. So in order to feel worthwhile, in order to feel alive, in order to feel real, we need to feel the impact of what we're doing. And that need to feel impact is the driving force behind everything. And if you look at what the psychologists a century ago or so were trying to figure out, what really drives the human being, and whether it's Freud's sex drive or Jung's power drive or whatever theories were presented at that time and subsequently, they are all offshoots of this basic premise, a need for feedback. What does power mean? That a human being needs to be able to feel that he can affect the world around him. That's the power. And Freud's sexual drive is a similar sort of a drive. One needs to feel that one can, that there is some kind of feedback. One cannot operate in a vacuum where you're transmitting outwards and you're receiving nothing back for it. The human being goes out of his mind if he's in that situation. He finds himself totally non-valued, unvalued, and worthless. And we have to be careful not to minimize the value of that need. On the one hand, we might say, that's covered, or a person needs covered, does he need honor, does he need glory? Surely a person can do it just the Shem Shammai. But it's not so. Hashem didn't make us that way. Hashem didn't make us in a way that we can operate without feedback. And we have to try and understand the need for feedback as not being in conflict with the concept of doing something l'shem shemayim. One can do something l'shem shemayim, one can do something for its own good, but even then there's the need for feedback. Because if there isn't the feedback, it's not that there wasn't recognition. If there isn't feedback, nothing was done. That's what we're really saying. A thing is only done when you can look at it and say, there it is, it's been done. As long as there's no feedback, as long as there's no impact, as long as an action has left no impression on its environment, then what has really been done? The fact that the subject went through some kind of a emotion is irrelevant if there's no impact on the environment. Take for example the musician, who's not an extrovert and is not a COVID seeker, he's a quiet sort of fellow, and all he lives for is his music. He plays the violin and that's all he lives for. And from morning till night, 7 days a week, he practices and he plays and he perfects, and there's nothing else in his life. Nothing else. Everything else is sacrificed for this. And he's got a performance coming up with one of the best orchestras in the world. It's been publicized all over. This is his chance. And there's going to be a huge audience there. And he practices for months and for months and for months. And he plays, and in his practicing he plays well, and he then, the evening comes, and he performs, and gets through his whole concerto, and at the end the audience gives him a standing ovation, they go crazy for him. What is happening here? What does he do it for the applause? So you'll say, no, he doesn't, he loves music. He doesn't do it for the applause. Does he do it for the chance to perform in front of the public? No, he loves music, he doesn't do it for that. He's doing it for his own sake. So what would happen if we said to him, so do, you know, if you're such a perfectionist and purist that you love music and you're doing it only for its own sake, forget the performances. Don't perform. Don't give any public performances. Don't get any applause. Sit in your studio and play 7 days a week. How long will that go on for? How long will he keep it up for? A few weeks, if that. And he'll start losing interest. So then we'll come along, the Balei Musar will come along and say, oh, you see, you're only doing it for the honor and the glory. The moment we take the honor and the glory away from you, you stop. But it's not true. Is he doing it for the honor and the glory? Isn't he doing it for the honor and the glory? He isn't doing it for the honor and the glory. He's doing it for his own sake. But he can't operate without feedback. He can put in 99 measures of practice for one measure of feedback. But that feedback has to be there. He has to have the opportunity to have impact on an audience. He has to have the opportunity to measure the response between himself and an audience. He has to have the opportunity to see the faces of his audience while he plays for them. He has to hear the applause when he's finished. It's terribly important. Not because he needs the COVID. He doesn't need the COVID. But he needs the feedback. And in this question of feedback, there are two kinds of feedback. There's what I call the paternal and the maternal feedback. And this is a feedback which children start getting used to at an early age. The maternal feedback is the feedback that leads to gratification and to pleasure. You do something, it requires an effort, but you get pleasure from it at the end of the day. It's enjoyable at the end of it. The paternal feedback is the recognition of having done a good job. So the maternal feedback, the child puts in an effort and does well, and the mother gives the child a hug and makes a special chocolate cake for him. That's the maternal kind of feedback. So the child feels pleasure as a result of the effort the child has put in. And the father, what is the paternal feedback? That doesn't mean that mothers don't sometimes give paternal and that fathers don't sometimes give maternal, but in trying to define the two types, the father's feedback is, that was very nicely done, son, good job, I'm proud of you. That's all. No chocolate cake, no hug, nothing. But that doesn't make it less valuable. Two different kinds of feedback. The fact is, something was done and it fulfilled his father's expectations of him, and that's feedback. So we have the feedback which comes is expressed in terms of gratification and pleasure, and we have the feedback that is expressed in terms of recognition of having fulfilled a duty. In the kind of society in which we operate, a dehumanized society, the need for feedback is even greater, shall we say, the thirst for feedback is even greater. So much of what we do doesn't seem to arouse feedback because it's all structured, it's all routine. The only time you get feedback is if you don't do the job, then you hear about it. As long as you're doing the job, you don't hear about it. Everything just goes normal, everything goes okay. If you don't do it or you slip up once, then you hear about it. Like that, it's not only like that in business and in professions, even in human relations it's like that. You can have a friendship that you can build over 20 years and there's no real feedback, and just put one step wrong, forget a birthday, and 20 years of friendship can go out of the window because a step has gone wrong there. And that's how our whole societies function. That's part of the tensions that we're living with. And so we're in search of the need for the sensation of being alive, because our normal lifestyle, the way we live from morning till night, doesn't give us a sense of being alive. When do you have a sense of being alive? Just think to yourself how you feel when you're driving to work in the morning, heavy traffic, thinking of the day ahead of you, thinking whether you're going to make it in time or not, stopping and starting and stopping and starting. and you stop it, you've stopped at a robot and you're waiting, and you turn aside and right next to you there's a car next to you, and instead of seeing the person next to you with the same kind of growling face that you've got on you, the person turns to you and gives you a nice big broad smile. What do you feel like? Incredibly good. Such a small thing, it's a stranger. Not a word was passed. Just a smile. Why does that make you feel so good? Feedback. You're alive. You really must be here. Somebody noticed you. I remember the thrill when I was learning to drive. And I was well underage at the time. And the biggest thrill, I'll never forget, was on Sylvia Pass, in fact, was when I had right of way and another car had to stop for me. That was fantastic. That meant that even though I was underage and I wasn't supposed to be driving and I was pretending that I didn't exist and I hoped everybody else would pretend that, another car had to stop for me. That means I really must exist. That's a wonderful feeling, to realize that you really must be alive because somebody noticed you. And we go through our lives not being noticed. And that creates severe tensions. And so we look for ways of reminding ourselves, of assuring ourselves that in fact we are alive. We look for sensations of being alive. And we find that in pleasure, we find that in fun, we find that in sport, we find that in social relations and so on. But there's another area too where there's a tremendous sense of being alive. And that is in the area of the fulfillment of a duty. If there's a gap in a job that has to be performed, if there's an area that needs to be attended to, and nothing's being attended to, and I'm able to identify that area, and fill that area, and do the job that needs doing, and at the end of it I can pull back and see the job has been done, that's another whole area of being able to feel alive, the fulfillment of a duty. And that's the paternal kind of feedback that comes. Nobody smiles at you, nobody says thank you. That's not the point. The point is that there's a certain sense of duty, there's a certain sense of mission. So the one kind of feedback that we seek is the pleasurable feedback, the feedback of emotional recognition. The love that we want to receive in return for the love that we give out. The recognition that we want to receive in return for the recognition that we give out, or for the efforts that we put in. And the other is simply the fulfillment of the duty, the sense of a certain mission. I think the tied to both these needs for feedback is the need to recognize the value of my own individuality, that I'm unique. And perhaps that's what is important, because we like to think that when that person smiled at us from the car alongside, that he smiled not just because I was anybody. He wouldn't smile at anybody. He smiled at me. That's what we would like to think. Although he doesn't know me, but there must be something about me that he found worth the smile. That's really what makes us feel good. If he smiles at every single car that comes past, when he smiles at us, it doesn't mean that much. But when we like to think that we were picked out by that person, whoever it is, it makes no difference. But it's a fellow human being who found it worthwhile, found something attractive enough or important enough or interesting enough about me to actually smile. And so it is in the sense of seeking feedback in the area of duties as well. The understanding that there's a sense of mission, that there's a duty, there's an obligation that I can fulfill that nobody else can or can do or can do to the same extent. And therefore, by my filling that gap, by my performing that duty, I feel I'm doing something which is unique. I'm doing something which nobody else can do. What happens if an individual has sacrificed his pleasures in life and or in an area of his life to the fulfillment of a duty? He's undertaken public office, and that means a tremendous amount of self-sacrifice. He can't do a lot of the things that other people find pleasure in doing, but he's doing it because he feels he has a contribution to make. There's a duty, there's a mission, there's an obligation that he can fulfill, and he can achieve a result in his society that nobody else would be able to achieve. And he does so, and he does so successfully. What happens if after years of doing so, we remove that duty from him? Now, we might have heard him during all the years of fulfilling that duty. The chances are we heard him say things like, I wish I could get rid of it. I wish I could find somebody else to take over. I'm getting tired of it. I'm getting too old for this. I want to retire. There's so many things I still want to do. I would like to have fun and pleasure like everybody else. I wish I could find somebody else to do the job. Finally, we find somebody else to do the job and we relieve him of his obligations. What happens? Where's my feedback going to come from now? I've sacrificed so much so that my sense of mission, that my sense of feedback should come from the fact that I fulfill this duty, that I perform this function, that the removal of that function from me leaves me without the ability to derive feedback. What am I going to do? Do what other people do? That doesn't give me any kind of pleasure anymore. I've geared myself and I've attuned myself to this type of feedback, to the feedback I get from this particular type of job, from this particular type of duty. And when we've removed this area of duty from him, there must inevitably start to develop within him a sense of worthlessness. So what now? Where's my feedback now? What happens the next day after Margaret Thatcher's no longer Prime Minister? How does she wake up the next morning with a feeling that none of her decisions today will make any difference to anybody? After 10 years of feeling that every decision I take today can affect the entire world, every decision I take, to wake up the next morning with a feeling no decision I take can possibly have any impact on anybody but me. Imagine such contrast. That's what happens when we take duty away from a person. How does one cope with such a change? And then we look around at the object when we feel that inadequacy, after a few weeks of it, after a few months of it, and we look around and we feel inadequate and we feel unable to affect the world. What happens when you find yourself in a situation that you can't control? What happens when you find yourself in a situation over which you can have no influence, in an environment that you cannot impact? What happens? A feeling of fear. The object becomes all powerful. I'm a nothing. Look at this. What will I do? How will I overcome it? How will I manage it? Everything becomes too big to handle, too enormous to cope with. And then there are two routes to take. Either submission, one just capitulates and goes along with it and allows oneself to be influenced by the environment. Then the subject becomes a function of the object. The individual becomes totally influenced now by his environment rather than the other way around, which is what most people do. Or escapism, just get away from it, drink, do whatever you need to do to escape, entertainment, escape from it. But one of the things that has happened during this psychological change that we've just described is a religious change too. Again, let's look at the person in office. And there he is, there's the Prime Minister or the Nossi or whoever, believing that he's fulfilling God's mission, believing that he was chosen to do this job by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and finding in that job enormous siyata dishmaya, because that's what happens in a position of leadership. A leader gets guidance from the Ribbono Shel Olam, not only commensurate with his own worth, he gets guidance from the Ribbono Shel Olam commensurate with the sum total of the worth of the people he's guiding to. So he's living with this constant feeling that he's the Ribbono Shel Olam's representative, acting on his behalf and affecting and influencing the world in his way, and he watches this relationship develop. All of a sudden, that ceases to exist. I'm a small individual, unable to impact on my environment. What happens to that relationship between the Ribbono Shel Olam and myself? Then we have a distancing that results from that. So there's a theological difference that results from the psychological change. As the psychology changes, as the self-image changes, so the relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam changes. On this parsha, on a different subject altogether, Rabbi Isaac Shur quotes the most beautiful Rashbo from Chulin. I haven't seen the Rashbo inside, so I'll read it to you from his quotation. Yesh bekoach ha-chasidim. There is within the power of righteous people, means real righteous people of those days, behidovek nafshom b'shorshom, when their souls are able to cleave and attach themselves to it, to their roots, lehis alois al kol maaseh hatachtonim. It is possible for those tzaddikim to elevate themselves above the workings of this lower world. Uleshanois hativim. And now that they find themselves operating on a higher level, on a higher plane, they can in fact influence nature. No longer are they influenced by nature, but by elevating themselves to that level, they are now able to influence nature. And if they actually start acting out and operating, utilizing the powers of the constellations, of the astral constellations, or the Gamri Migedra Teva to Kriyas Yamsuf, Kinyan Shosomeshab Yamsuf, they can change nature totally, like Moshe did at the Red Sea. And certainly they can change nature when it's only a minor change, like the stopping of a river from flowing. That's easy. And all that is because they elevate themselves up on top, and the top operates on the bottom. This world doesn't affect that, the upper world affects this world, and if a tzaddik can elevate himself to the point where he's operating on that level rather than on this level, he can in fact change the world, he can change nature, he can affect nature. That's the power of the individual. That's the potential power of the individual. And when a tzaddik finds himself operating on that level, it's a Moshe Rabbeinu, a Nossi, a Melech, and he finds himself sometimes having to utilize that. Sometimes having to modify nature even in order to serve the interests of the people as the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to be served. And all of a sudden you remove him from his position. There's that lovely medrash we dealt with years ago when Moshe Rabbeinu pleads with the Ribbono Shel Olam to allow him to live on, to come into Eretz Israel and to live as a retired ordinary citizen. He doesn't want the job. Quite willing and happy to give up the job. He's been saying that all the time. Moshe Rabbeinu is one of the few who didn't want the job to start with, and constantly, whenever it really gets difficult, pleads with the Ribbono Shel Olam to relieve him of it. And even right at the end, he says, give it to Yeshua, I don't have a problem. Just let me live a little longer. And there's that lovely medrash where Hashem lets him live a little longer. And Yeshua is called into the Mishkan to communicate with Hashem. And when Yeshua comes out, Moshe goes up to him with a broad smile on his face beaming, so proud to see his Talmud that he'd nurtured for 40 years, to see his Talmud take his place, go into the Mishkan, communicate with Ribbono Shel Olam, and he goes up to Yeshua and he puts his arms around him and he says, Yeshua, what did Hashem have to say? And Yeshua basically answers, none of your business, Moshe. It's between me and Hashem. It's not your business anymore. And at that point Moshe turns to Hashem and says, I'm ready to go. I can't live like this. What's happened? Why not? He wanted life. That sense of duty has been taken away from him. And what is he left with? A distance from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what brought him to want to end his life. Not the fact that he didn't have the job anymore. Whereas beforehand, I was the first line of communication with God. That's been broken. I'm not that anymore. So there's been a distance, there's been a withdrawal in the relationship between me and Hashem. And normally we're used to seeing that withdrawal in the sense of God distancing himself from us. But sometimes it's the other way around. It's because we're distancing ourselves from him. And when a person's self-esteem, take a tzaddik, a chosid, the type of person that the Rashbo is talking about, one of these very great people who's able to elevate himself to the level where he can even affect nature, when he is threatened with the loss of that status, when he starts to doubt his own self-esteem, what is one of the first things that suffer? His relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. I no longer have that intimacy. That's the part that becomes so difficult. I no longer have that intimacy. And so we find that even bitochen to a degree, security and trust in Hashem, can be affected not only by one's theological doubts of Hashem's ability. That's for sure, that's the normal loss of bitochen. But here we have a new idea. That one's level of bitochen, one's level of trust in God can be diminished by a diminished sense of one's own ability. That when we feel worthless, that damages our relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam. It's not only theologically a lack of bitochen, is when we say, God can't do such and such. What's going to happen? God can't help me. That's one kind of lack of bitochen. But there's another kind, which is, I'm a nobody, I'm a useless, I'm a nothing. God won't help me because I don't have that relationship with him. That also leads to a distancing. And it's that leads the Meraglim to say, and of all the things they say, this is the most serious and the most telling of their whole attitude. After they come back and they give their reports and Kolev tries to reverse it, and the men then say, the 10 people say, Loi nuchal la'aloi salam, we cannot conquer this nation. Ki chazok hu mimenu, because it is too strong for us. Now the word mimenu can mean one of two things. It can mean from us, too strong for us, or it can mean too strong for him. And Chazal learn it, Chazaku Mimenu, too strong for him, Kibiyochel Klape Maila Omru. As if they were implying this is even too strong for God. Even he can't manage this. What kind of nonsense is that? 10 tzaddikim, leaders of the Jewish people, after what they've been through with Kriyas Yamsuf, Yitzias Mitzrayim, Hasinai, talking about this is too hard for God. What do they mean this is too hard for God? They're not saying it's too hard for God, that God can't do it. What they're saying, this is too hard for the alliance that exists between us and the Ribbono Shel, because we're not on the level to be able to deserve the kind of miracles that will be needed to achieve this victory. A diminishment of self-esteem results in a diminishment of belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam's ability to. Not because he can't, but because we fear he won't. After all, who are we? And here we see the real damage, and here we see the real danger. When the Zohar says these people were worried about the loss of their jobs, what was this? Was this arrogance or was this humility? On the superficial reading, it's arrogance. All they want is to keep their job. But if you read it more carefully, it isn't. It's humility. It's a belief we won't be good enough for the job in Eretz Yisrael. Who could be better than them? They are the best. They don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as okay for the Midbar, but not okay for Eretz Yisrael. Because Eretz Yisrael has too much kedusha. The level of the people in Eretz Yisrael is going to be so infinitely higher than it is over here that we can't be leaders for them. We won't be in a position to be their leaders. They'll need greater leaders than us. So the basic feeling is one of humility, is one of modesty, not one of arrogance, and one of recognition of the value of Eretz Yisrael. So why does that lead them to read something so negative into it? It leads them to read something negative into it because they don't believe in the ability of themselves, their people, and Hashem as a unit to be able to conquer the land, because we're not great enough. And that feeling of we're not great enough is so destructive, is so negative. It's interesting, also Rabbi Isaac Sher brings, once again I don't have the necessary sforim to look at this in the sources, but it's fascinating. He brings a tshuva of the Rambam quoted in the Kalba in Simon Kuf Chof Zayin, about a person asking about the mitzvah of going to Eretz Israel, what it entails, how important it is, and so on. Says the Rambam, what you've got to do is be Yizoyer Michol Mine Ovei. First thing is, if you're going to Eretz Israel, make sure that there are no sins, there are no averas that you're involved in. You're beyond that already. Be Yekayim Kol HaMitzvahs HaNoagos Boretz, and that you're familiar and able and willing to keep all the mitzvahs that apply to Eretz Israel, Shemitah and Maisa and Truma and everything. Because when a person commits an Aveiro in Eretz Yisrael, his punishment is much greater than if he commits an Aveiro in Chutz Loretz. Because Hashem always watches Eretz Yisrael. Hashem is always with Eretz Yisrael. And he is concerned about it, so you are watched much more carefully and with much more meticulous attention to detail in Eretz Yisrael than you're watched elsewhere. And you can't compare a rebellious person when his act of rebellion is in the palace to when it's outside of the palace. If you want to stand and put banners up against the government, that's one thing. But if you're invited to a banquet at the president's residence and in the middle of the banquet you put up your banner, that's unforgivable. And therefore, in Eretz Yisrael, that's Hashem's palace. If you want to do an Aveiros, bad enough. Do it in Chutz Loretz. If you go to Eretz Yisrael, that's not the place to do anything wrong. And then he quotes from our parsha, the Rambam. It's a land that destroys its inhabitants. It will reject any transgressors. And then Rabbi Zishur brings that the Peas Shulchan asks, how can the Rambam quote from the words of the Meraglim? Surely that isn't an accurate description of Eretz Israel. It says it's a land that destroys its inhabitants. That's what the Meraglim said. That's what the spies said. That's not what Yeshua and Kolev said. And he answered, "The Rambam sovar the vaday hamiraglim loy dibru chozov." Clearly, they didn't tell lies. The spies didn't tell lies. Rak hamiraglim choshvu ze l'ra beginua. The miraglim thought this was negative, and they talked negatively about it. Ki koshe leishiv shom v'lizor bechol haTorah, because they realized how difficult it is to live in Eretz Israel as a tzaddik. But if you don't live in Eretz Israel as a tzaddik, it can be very dangerous. It can be very harmful. And so the Meraglim, it isn't that they saw terrible things and they came back with deceitful reports and with dishonest reports. Not at all. All they're saying is that land is powerful. You need to be a tzaddik to conquer it. You need to be a tzaddik to survive in it. It's not for us. That's what they said. We're not on that level. And that's what the Zohar means when they realized that if they went into Eretz Israel, they would no longer be leaders. And if not them, who? Nobody. They realized the whole nation wasn't fit to go into Eretz Israel. It wasn't just a question of sticking to the job. It's true, the Zohar says, and Moshe would have to appoint others. And that bothered them, that there could be others who would be able to take it, who would be able to operate on that level. But one thing they saw for certain, it wasn't going to be them. They couldn't operate on that level. And finally, we need to have a look at what is the antidote. If that is the effect of diminished self-esteem, if a person who is potentially great, or actually great as in their case, doubts that greatness, because concerned about his potential, What is the route to take? How does one prevent it? So we see the two who were saved were Kalev and Yehoshua. How was Yehoshua saved? The one way is of reinforcement of self-esteem through the inherent godliness within the individual. If we look at ourselves as lacking godly content, if we look at ourselves as without a neshama, as without having within us a part of Hashem Himself, then of course there's going to be diminished self-esteem. Who are we after all? But if we're able to see within ourselves that godliness, there's an opportunity to be able to come right. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't just pray for Yehoshua. In addition to that, he adds the Yud to Yehoshua's name. Know Yehoshua, the name is the symbol of individuality. The name is the symbol of identity. You, Yehoshua, are great. And you're great not just because of the feedback. You're great because you've got the Ribbono Shel Olam within you. You contain the Ribbono Shel Olam. You've got the Ribbono Shel Olam behind you. You've got the Ribbono Shel Olam with you. You're not just Hoshea, you're Yehoshua. The Yud, the Ribbono Shel Olam's name, is included in your name. He's part of you. Never forget that. And if we're able to take that with us and to understand that we do contain the Ribbono Shel Olam within us, and as ordinary as we sometimes think we are, and as ordinary as we sometimes fear we are, and sometimes even less than ordinary, we need to understand what our potential is. That within us we have the Ribbono Shel Olam. That within us we have a Nishmas Yisroel. We have the most precious of all things, a Jewish soul. What that can only achieve, what that can only develop into, what power that gives us, what ability that gives us to overcome the difficulties and the challenges with which we're faced, if we understand the value and the importance of that Yud, of that Ribbono Shel Olam which exists within us. And the second method was Kolev. Kolev's name was not changed, and he didn't have the Yud within himself. So what did Kolev do? It's interesting that when they went off to Eretz Yisrael, it says Vayalu vaNegev, and they went up through the Negev, Vayovoy ad Chevron, and he came to Chevron. Changes from the plural to the singular. They went up through the Negev, and he came to Chevron. And Chazal work out from Sukkim further on that it was only Kolev who went to Chevron. And what did he do going to Chevron? Chevron was a dangerous place to go to even in those days. As the Pasuk tells us, V'shom Achimon Sheshai V'Talmai Yelidei HaAnok. They were Achimon Sheshai Talmai, the children of the giants. Why does the Torah tell us this? It's important to know that Kolev took his life into his hands. He went into an extremely dangerous part of the land all by himself. What did he go there for? Say Chazal, in order to daven, but not just to daven. Nishtateach, says Rashi, al kivrei ovus. He went to daven and to bow down at the Maras HaMachpelo, at the graves of his fathers. Shelo yehei nises lechaveirov liyis ba'atzosom. That he should not be tempted and provoked by his friends to join in their plot and their scheme. Fine, that he davened, I understand. Why didn't he go to the Kosel HaMa'arovi? Why did he go to Chevron, to this dangerous area? Because it's not just the davening, it's understanding where you come from that's important. He understood too, this was a loss of self-esteem that was taking place. This was personal crisis that the Nesiim were going through. This was questioning, am I worthy? Are we worthy? And he realized the danger. Yeshua's fine, Yeshua's been given a Yud in his name, he'll be alright. What about me? Kolev goes to the graves of his forefathers to realize, I can talk to Hashem myself, I can daven. And who am I descended from? What mishpacha do I come from? What family do I come from? Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Those are the people I'm descended from. I don't have to doubt my self-worth. I don't have to doubt who I am. I don't have to doubt whether the Ribbono Shel Olam will help me. I don't have to doubt whether Klal Yisrael will be able to do this or they won't. We're children of Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov. We don't have a problem with that. The Ribbono Shel Olam is with us. And with that reinforcement of his self-esteem, he is able to move forward. And that's where we see that the self-esteem that is so important, and that psychologists talk so much about today, and yet they find it so difficult to really build it in people, because all they've really got are techniques, but not the internal structure that needs to be there. Let's have a look and see what is that internal structure, and you'll see right away why psychology can't help. The one internal structure is the Yud in the name. Hashem is within us. If a psychologist will say that, he'll be struck off the roll. Can't talk religion when you're talking psychology. But that's how you develop self-esteem. Hashem is within you. I can stand and I can say Shemona Esra by myself. I can talk to Hashem. I can say Shema Yisrael by myself. I can be Mispalel by myself. I can learn Torah. I can open the Ribbono Shel Olam's Sforim and I can learn them and understand them. We feel a tremendous self-esteem if we're able to open the writings of Einstein and understand them. We feel very good. We feel very good if we're able to open some sophisticated writer or philosopher's work and to be able to read it and understand it and analyze it and master it. We feel very good. We can take the Ribbono Shel Olam's work, the creator of all minds, of all intellects, and we can analyze his system of reasoning in the Gemara with the Rishonim and the Acharonim, and we can master that too. Tremendous sense of self-esteem can be derived out of that if we'll make the effort. And the other is our yichus, to realize who we are, what family we come from, who our mishpacha is. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Those are the two legs that self-esteem stand on. The godliness within me and the family from which I come. And with that knowledge, one is able to look around at any challenge and say the enormity of the challenge is irrelevant. No challenge can be greater than the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. And 10 out of the 12 spies thought it was an impossible thing to achieve. But as I said this morning, the majority is always wrong. It was only 2 who said it is possible. Because that partnership between the Ribbono Shel Olam and myself, between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Jewish people, is a partnership to whom no challenge can be too big. It's a partnership that is able to achieve anything that the Ribbono Shel Olam wishes it to achieve.